Hey, Link here. Thanks for joining me for episode 76, where I speak with Osama Dorius, lead gameplay designer at Brass Lion Entertainment. We talk about the staples, like how Osama got into gaming, words of wisdom from their experience, the games that made them want to get into the industry, and what they do outside of gaming. We also talk about the game they feel doesn't get enough credit, learn more about how his brain as a game designer works, and also touch on the importance of why representation inside of games, as well as the industry, matters. Before we get started, don't forget there are links in the description that you can follow to learn more about Osama as well as the podcast. Also, don't forget to like and share the episode. And without further ado, enjoy episode 76. Hi, and welcome to the Red Tunic Podcast, a podcast where I look to rediscover what makes gaming fun and enjoyable by having positive conversations with those related to the industry. My name is Link, and today I'm joined by Osama Dorius, currently lead gameplay designer at Brass Lion Entertainment, and has previously a game designer that has worked at companies like Blizzard, WB Games, and Ubisoft, as well, currently a professor at Dawson College, advisor to GDC, and one of the Habibis. Hi, Osama, how are you doing today?
Hey, Link. I'm doing great. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm happy to hear that you're doing great. And, you know, you are more than welcome to be invited. I really should be saying the honor is all mine. I really appreciate you making the time to be here. So thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. It absolutely is.
So, Osama, before we get started, do you mind telling me and anyone listening a little bit about yourself, maybe your current projects or what have you? And if you wish as well, feel free to maybe throw in how you got into developing and making games or whatnot. You know, whatever you feel people need to know as a foundation for who you are.
Of course. So I was born in Iraq. Let's start at the beginning. I moved out of there before the Iran-Iraq war. We came to Canada when I was about 5 years old. Been here ever since, in Montreal, Canada specifically. And the adventure, the journey to become a game designer was actually a pretty interesting one, because I've been making games since I was really, really young. Not video games initially, it was board games and card games. But I made them since I was like 7, 8 years old. I remember always like creating sports, creating games, that kind of thing. Drawing comic books and doing other entertainment things. When we first got a home video camera, I used to make movie shorts. Very creative, loved entertainment, and contributed to it a lot. I did that. I even remember a specific story from when I was about like 9 or 10 years old, when my dad went out for pizza and I asked him if he could bring back an empty pizza box. And he looked at me very confused. But at this point, you know, he was so used to my weird request. So he shrugged. He said, okay, fine, I'll ask them. And he brought back this box that I made a board game inside it, a pop-up board game that you didn't need to put away. You just had to close the lid of the box and it was gone. And I loved it. Like, I thought it was so clever. The game wasn't really that great. I was like 9 or 10. Like, give me a little bit of, cut me some slack. But that was me. And then eventually I started making mods for video games that I would play. Like, I made levels for Heroes of Might and Magic 3, StarCraft, Unreal Tournament, even before Unreal Tournament, Duke Nukem. Like, anything that had an editor, I was there modding, right? And I never considered making games, even though I was doing it at a young age. It wasn't one of the jobs that comes to mind when you're, if I'm perfectly honest, when you're an Arab immigrant, it's like there are just a few options that are very apparent to you. Engineer or any variation of it, doctor or any variation of it, or front and center, maybe lawyer makes it to top three. And so, because I was always artistic in a sense and creative, I wanted to be an architect. Because I was an engineer that, you know, did some drawings and planned out spaces. And those are things I enjoyed. But not the short version of the story is I changed my mind right before going to university. And I ended up studying political science, even though I had no interest in working in it, just because it interested me. And then I worked as a shipping agent after school. because I didn't want to be a politician, and there were very few options for people who studied political science and didn't want to be a politician. And I had a love-hate relationship with that job because I loved going on ships and meeting captains, but I absolutely did not like the customs paperwork. That hurts my brain. I know now that I have ADHD, so I understand completely why that part of the job was so painful for me. But I did that for about a year. And then I was back to square one, not knowing what I wanted to do. And I became a freelance graphic web designer simply because when I was 14, I had read a book, How to Make Websites in 21 Days, in a weekend. And I started making websites. And I still had that muscle memory. I was still making like websites whenever, just for fun on the side. I'm like, wait, I already have another thing that I could do. And I started making website as a freelancer, and I wasn't very good at the business side, so sometimes I had to pick up, like, you know, call center jobs here and there just to make ends meet. But generally I was a graphic web designer, and that taught me Flash, which meant I, for the first time in my life, I was able to make video games, not non-digital games like board games and card games, which I still love to do, or mods for existing games, but my own from scratch video games. And I did. I made a whole bunch of Flash games, and they weren't great, but I loved them. And I did that for a few years until one of my friends from school, he did a minor in political science, but he was a history major. He got a job as a game designer, and he was of Palestinian descent, actually. He was Arab. And he's the first person I saw that was like me who got, you know, into the industry, and something clicked in my head. I was like, what, this is a possibility? He became my first mentor in the industry. I went to him and I said, help me. And he like looked over my games and taught me how to do a design document, and helped me set up a portfolio. And after a little while told me, okay, I think you're ready to keeping in mind, like, he just got a job. Like, he's a junior in the industry, right? But he still had way more experience than I did because I had like zero. He helped me build a portfolio and apply, and I applied to like hundreds of jobs over the next few months, like almost 6 months, and I heard nothing. To be quite honest, I took a break from it, and I'm not sure if I actually took a break or if I gave up. But because I told everyone that I was taking a break, but in my heart, I wasn't sure if I was going to go back. I felt so dejected because I didn't even get a single interview. I didn't get any response that wasn't automated. Like, it wasn't a, I made, like, it was 6 months of no progress. After 6 months of working on a portfolio, in a time where you couldn't study, like, this is a long time ago, you couldn't even study game design. Like, it wasn't really an option. And I didn't know what else to do. I didn't have any other options. I'd like to think that I would have, you know, restarted again, but I didn't have to because I got one call back from a company called Gameloft. They were making a mobile game that was a poker game. And the only reason they called me back is on one of my interests, I wrote that I liked poker. And they were looking for a poker expert to work on a poker game. That was literally the only reason. And it's not like I played poker a lot. It wasn't a very big interest. I barely even put, it was the last item on my list. You never know what little thing can make a huge difference. And when they asked me, so are you a poker expert? I said, hell yeah. But I wasn't really a poker expert. I was just a person who played casually here and there. But I, you know, called in sick from whatever call center job I had at the time. Went to the bookstore, bought 5 poker books, and didn't sleep for 2 days. And then I aced that interview. I was the only person who got every question right. And the truth is, I would have gotten every question wrong. They weren't asking things that a person who plays poker casually would know. They were asking about high-level concepts that only a poker expert would know. Like, what is a continuous play? What is a rule of 2 and 4? Like, things that you won't know unless you're part of that world. And I had crammed for that test. So I passed and I got the job, and that's how I got into the industry. That is, believe it or not, the short version of that story, but you know.
So thank you for sharing that. And, you know, to start off, for anyone that's listening and does not know any of the stuff that you were just talking about, mainly Flash, Flash was how we used to have to play video games through web browsers. They don't exist anymore. They're gone. But that is how that used to work. And they also used to be full of viruses, according to some people. Crazy people, mind you. But anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there first.
Thank you.
Because, you know,
Yeah, no, that's absolutely fair. I should have thought about that.
Oh no, I'm making a joke. By all means, do not think this is an actual educational experience on my part. But no, I think that's fantastic that, you know, that is how you got started. I also find it interesting. I don't know the right way to phrase this, so by all means, please don't think in any way that I'm phrasing this that it's patronizing or what have you.
No, of course.
But I like that part of the story that inspired you to try or apply or what have you, stick your foot into the water, was realizing and seeing representation of someone like you.
Absolutely.
Because you know, a lot, and I don't think that's a unique thing, but I think it's a fantastic thing because, like, for the longest time, video games, or at least the perception for video games, that it was just like some white dude in like, they're just some white dude, some white dorky dude making games, or maybe not a white dorky dude, just a white dude that excelled at business or what have you, if you look at certain aspects of like EA. And then as you like learn more about who was who was actually doing things, and you see like in your case, seeing, you know, who became, who was your first mentor, seeing someone that was like you doing that and being able to go, oh wow, this is not just a domain for white dudes.
Yes.
Which is, you know, which is great because, like I said, you know, a lot of people don't realize that, in the same way that a lot of people like don't want to always play just like a Butch Army dude in a game because every other one's about a Butch Army dude. They want to play as, you know, someone that they can relate to or what have you.
Very well said. And yeah, absolutely. Like it's like you said, this is not unique. This is pretty much universal for all marginalized people. We're not just not used to seeing ourselves in certain positions, and it's really hard to project yourself onto something that you haven't seen someone emulate before you. That's just normal. That's a paradigm in your mind that you have to kind of break and shift. And that's why I really do believe in representation, both in game development and in games, as you mentioned, because that's the same thing. That's part of it. One is a reflection of the other, and almost all protagonists of any game that I played growing up were not me, right? They didn't look like me, they didn't talk like me, or anything like that. It's actually one of the reasons that I'm really a huge fan of fighting games, because fighting games were some of the first games to break that. It was warriors from around the world. Not many games had that. If you look at them, the list of games from the past 30 years, and before that, it was, you know, almost one category of character, right? And all the other types of characters combined didn't equal a small percentage of, you know, white male protagonists, as you put it.
Yeah, and you know, yeah, like you know, like I don't think there's much more to say, just because at that point it'd be beating a horse. But yes, and you know, it that's also a really interesting point to make about like fighting games that I'm thinking on it now. Yeah, you're right. I can't really think of other games where there was like any form of protagonist where it was that. I'm saying protagonist in air quotes, not to be like, you know, counter to what you're saying, but just in the sense of it's a fighting game, right? But that's really a good point, because I can't think of any other games where you could play as a well varied crew cast. Correct words that I'm struggling for that kind of work, I don't know.
Yeah, at best it was an abstracted character that was none of these things, and those were great, but it's not enough. And you're right, we're beating a dead horse. We can move on.
So, you know, in that same vein as well, I also find it very amusing that like, when you got started, you thought of using like a pizza box to try and make like a pop-out game. And you know, back then, regardless of like as you said, you don't, you know, you weren't, you don't think you were making good ones or what have you. Regardless though, back then, those ideas would have been wild and nonsensical in the sense of like a board game. But if you look at like the climate today in board games, that's something that would probably be considered a groundbreaking and very fun idea. So, you know, if you want to go back to it, the market might be there for you.
Finally, after all these years, almost 35 years, I can make my pizza box pop-up board game. Thank you for the validation, Link.
Your dreams can finally be reality.
I've been waiting for this moment.
I'm glad I could be a part of it.
Thank you. Thank you. A big part.
Now, as a follow-up to all of that, I am curious, you know, from your experiences, from the things that you learned and the pitfalls that I'm sure you might have ran up against or into, do you have any words of wisdom that you might be able to share so that anyone listening might maybe also be able to avoid those same pitfalls?
Absolutely. If you're talking specifically about people who want to get into the games industry, the first thing I'll say is that my reality is very different. When I was coming into games, that was 16 years ago now. It was very different than it is now. And I have to acknowledge that. Like, any advice I would give myself back then wouldn't be very relevant now. The situation back then is, as I said, there were very few game design programs and none near me. So many of them were far away, and there were very few to begin with, but they were very distributed far away and not exactly something that you could study to get into the industry. It was mostly academic things, so you could teach the theory of game design, which is valuable if you want to teach, less valuable if you wanted to work in the medium. That has changed since then. Now you could learn about it. YouTube technically did exist at that time, but it didn't have any tutorial. I got in the industry 2007. I think YouTube was created in 2006. That's why I said barely existed. It was in its onset. The only videos you could find there is people who forgot to set privacy on the video of their family visiting the zoo. It was that kind of. Those are the kind of videos you can find. Now you could learn almost anything you want to learn on YouTube alone. And that's not even counting all the online paid classes that have instructors from the industry that can teach you what you need. Even if you don't want to or can't afford to go to a university program. University programs, let's face it, they have their own problems. They usually cost an arm and a leg, and the placements aren't always very high. But the climate is different. Better in some ways, worse in others. Before, how do you build a portfolio? How do you learn to do the thing? You kind of have to throw yourself into it by yourself and figure it out by yourself, which is what I did. Now you can learn it, but so can so many other people. And therefore, the portfolios that I'm seeing now of people who are applying for junior positions are, no joke, better than what I could do when I had 5 years of experience in the industry. That's just the reality of it. The context is different in that way, because people are able to get to those levels faster. Just if you're talking about game development is broad, but if you're talking about game design alone, just the Game Maker's Toolkit video channel, that knowledge on that channel alone far exceeds what I knew when I was a senior in the industry with 5 years of experience. And it's at kids' fingertips. I met a 13-year-old not too long ago who watched a channel and was quoting it and understood game design theory and was making games in Unity. And I was that kind of thing was just non-existent back then. The access to the knowledge wasn't there. But as I said, that means you're competing with a lot more people. So the reality now, it's a little bit different. And when I say now, I mean generally now, because if we're specifically talking about the last year, another sad reality is that the market now is not good. There have been so many layoffs in the industry, estimated at being over 6,000 layoffs just in the last year, that even some seniors are struggling to find work. And that was unheard of for the 5 years before that. It was a employee market, you could pick where you wanted to work. And now reality, you have to face a reality. It's more slim pickings. It's going to bounce back. These things are cyclical. It's not the first time we've gone through this. The recessions come and go. But a lot of people, unfortunately, they graduated a year ago, it coincides with that. Or they decided they wanted to make games a year ago. That's part of it. So people who are internalizing the reality that I went through, where I wasn't getting any feedback at all, it's so much worse now. And people are thinking, it has something to do with them or their portfolios, and that's just not the reality. And we have to, you have to enjoy the journey, because there are no guarantees that you're going to make it. And the other sad reality is a lot of people make it and then they realize it's not what they thought it was, and they get disappointed because it's a job. There are really good things about it. I love my job. I love making games. I couldn't see myself in any other career. And there are really bad, difficult things about game making as well that people are not preparing themselves for, especially when they have like a dream project or a dream studio. And then they show up and they realize that it does not live up to their ideals. None of them do. They're just jobs. They're just jobs that are different. And so, going to the advice. This is context. I'm sorry.
No worries. Context is always key. It's always, yes, good, right?
Absolutely. So the advice is pretty universal, regardless of what discipline you want to go into. The first step is you have to actually learn how to do the thing. Having ideas is not doing the thing. Having potential to learn is not doing the thing. The time for that, or the chances of you getting in because of anything like that, are slim to none in the best of circumstances now, because of all the applicants and where they are in terms of their application. So you have to actually do the thing. You have to do it to a certain level, and that threshold keeps increasing. So you have to make sure not only that you're willing to do that, that you're actually doing that and you're on a path to keep improving your portfolio. The second layer of challenge, unfortunately, is that you have to be prepared for the chances that it's not going to work out mentally. If you tie your happiness to this succeeding, this is a passion industry. And I hate that word, but it's actually accurate. I don't like it because it means that we get exploited by the industry in a lot of different ways, especially when we're junior. That is the part that I dislike. The part that is actually true is that many people want to work in this industry, just like any other passion industry. And as a result, passion industry, it's like, you know, the laws of economy, supply and demand, right? There are more people who want to get in than there are jobs. Even if you're amazing, there's just a layer of randomness that you cannot control. So based on all of these things, you have to make sure you're enjoying the journey and planning for it not working out, and not tying your happiness with the ultimate goal as much as possible. The third thing is, I said this is universal across any discipline, but also don't assume that what you want to do is what you actually want to do until you tried a variety of things. Like, no joke, before doing that, I thought I wanted to do animation. And I actually fiddled around with animation before. And I love animation, I really do. But and when I was working in Flash, I tried a whole bunch of things. And I'm like, I actually just prefer the rules that make the game. I prefer the game design. But I didn't know I preferred the game design. If you remember when I was young, I didn't only make games. I drew comic books. And I tried to do little, you know, like animations and drawings. And I really thought I was going to be either a comic book artist or a cartoon. Not thought I could be. Sorry, that's actually not accurate at all. But I thought it would be a hobby, that I would continue doing this throughout my life. And I would just have a series of comics that I would only share among my friends. Like, that was a thing I really thought that it was going to be more on the art side. And then when I tried the design side, that pleased my brain more. And I did a pivot. And I know a lot of people who did the opposite pivot or different pivots all over the place. I've had students who start to learn game design and focus on the art and shift and change programs. And I encourage them to do that. Because you don't know what you don't know. And you don't know what you actually like. And there are so many sub-disciplines. So keep an open mind. Try all the things. Sample. And then decide where you want to lean into. And the fourth advice is universal, and it's going to sound extremely basic. It's actually a 3-in-1, because it is universal, but it is true, and you cannot get away from it. As even if you know everything, if you cannot display it in a portfolio of some kind, if you don't have work that you can show, then you are setting yourself up for failure already. You have to be able to show the work. So portfolio is really important. Up-to-date portfolio that you keep working on is really important. Like, even if a portfolio is decent, but it's been dated and not updated, and it has a time limit. It doesn't become relevant anymore, or even it sheds doubt whether you still know, right, that you still have those muscles flexed. Unfortunately, that is the case. So making a portfolio is a process, an active process. It's not a checkbox that you say, okay, it's done now. That's the other part of it, which everyone talks about. I know it's very universal, but it's also incredibly important. Network. Because there are many gatekeepers in this industry, just like any other industry. And the first gatekeepers are generally algorithms in bigger companies. They go through your CV. CV is a Canadian term, I think, right? So your resume. And they match words. They just try to see if you are an applicant that has a word match similar to, generally, the job posting. And then that gets a score. And the ones with the highest scores land on the desk of the second gatekeeper, which is usually the recruiter or the recruitment team. Depending on the size of the studio, there are extra gatekeepers or fewer gatekeepers, right? Tiny studios generally, all like one or two steps are skipped. After the recruiter verifies with their eyes that this is not a deception of some sort and someone's fooling the algorithm, they will take the highest ranked vetted applicants and put them on the hiring manager's desk, which is the third gatekeeper. The hiring manager is going to look through less the resume, but still, and more the portfolio in general, depending on the discipline, or provide or recommend a test or something along those lines, in order to answer the questions of, can this person do the job? And that is the primary question that they're going to want answered. And so a more varied, strong portfolio that exhibits all the good things is a plus. If you have a portfolio that says, these are the broad things I'm working on, and then one click deep, and these are the details of what I actually did, and then one click deeper, and this is the process of what I did in order to get there, that is a perfect portfolio, because then it could satisfy every level of gatekeeping, you know, that you would need to satisfy. Because the recruiter doesn't want to be bogged down with the details. That's not their job. That's not their expertise. But the hiring manager will want to see an overview of what you worked on, and then be able to dig down on what they care about and see the actual work. So a well-structured portfolio is going to go a long way. And the fourth gatekeeper usually is a group of people. It's a panel interview to see if, okay, this person can do the job, but do we want to work with them? So it's generally pulled from a lot of stakeholders or possible collaborators. And they're just going to ask a series of, you know, can we work with this person question. They might even ask details about, like, what can you do? Because this is the need that we have, you know, specific to that. So we have layers of gatekeeping, and your portfolio is going to answer some of them. And the network can bypass a few. So that's where I come back to the network. Who you know is a big part of it. And if you know somebody, then they can refer you. And if they refer you, you're skipping, if there is one in that company, the algorithm, and often the recruiter. And you're going straight to the hiring manager with a referral of someone who says, this is a person I want to work with, potentially not bypassing, but adding to the voice of the fourth gatekeeper. So depending on how strong your referral is, how strong your network is, because your referral might be the hiring manager, and that's skipping almost everything, right? Depending on the structure and the process that they have. And so who you know, networking is a huge modifier. But that your chances of you getting that job without the portfolio, without the other things, are very low. It'll just help you clear some gatekeepers. And the portfolio does the same thing. So they play hand in hand. And the issue is, like, people don't understand really what networking is in general, what I've noticed. Like, most people don't get that really networking properly is not a transactional situation. It's not a transactional relationship. And if you make it a transactional relationship, you're going to fail at networking. It's not, hey, I need a job, give it to me, so I want to shake your hand and give you my business card. That is the worst expression of what networking is. It's, hey, I am a person and you are a person, and I would like to have a connection with you. A friendship maybe will develop from it at some point, but at least a friendly connection. I will take interest in what you have to say and what you do. I will ask you questions and learn from you. That is a better network. And even though this question is mostly about how do we get in, and that's usually the focus, even people who are already in the industry, I always tell them, don't wait until you need it to network. Build your networks, build your friend, you know, your connections with other friends across different companies all the time if you can. And I know this is a hard ask of certain people. Not everyone's as extroverted as I am. I am extroverted. But it is definitely a necessary thing. And I promise you that this point was three. So portfolio is one, network is the other. And the third part is a combination of both. It's a shortcut. That's not really a shortcut, but you know, I like to present it that way. It's try your best to get a mentor. Because with a mentor, you get a network and you get help with your portfolio. And it's easier said than done, because a lot of people are really afraid of the M word, because they're afraid that it comes with a certain level of expectation and responsibility and accountability. And that, although that is true, it doesn't have to. So I've actually found more success, both myself and giving this advice to other people, is just don't use the M word, but be very clear and honest about what you want. And a simple way to do this is, if you have a portfolio, which you should before you reach out to a mentor to a degree, anything at all. I've tried it. I've looked it up. Anything at all. Because you don't want to waste their time. You want to come with targeted questions or, you know, seeking specific help. You could reach out to a person who you'd like to be your mentor. And remember that most of the people that you are aware of, most people are aware of as well. Therefore, they're getting normally bombarded with these requests. So not only should you spread it, you know, wide. Remember, my first mentor was a junior who had been working only for a few months. And that's still a level up for you if you haven't been in the industry. If you find a junior, they're much less likely to have an inbox full of requests. And they'll more likely be able to spend more time with you. And the reality of how long they've been in the industry is probably going to be closer to your context. And so spread it out. You know, like, you could still shoot your shot and try to get that creative director on the project of your dreams. But, you know, manage your expectations and just approach them with a one-time commitment. Be honest, like, you know, say, hey, I have a portfolio. Mind giving me feedback on it? That's it. And then, you know, open mind, listen, take their feedback, because they're going to pay attention to every time you resist their feedback. And they're going to pay attention to every time you don't challenge or question either, because that's not, both extremes are bad. The, oh, but this is what I want to do, that's bad. That person can't take feedback. And the, okay, whatever you want, that's bad too, because that person's not going to learn. They're just going to execute. So find that balance where you're actually curious and asking and learning and applying the feedback. And like that, you actually have to have the intention to apply the feedback. And then all you do is say, oh, thank you, this was great. I'm going to take some time to apply this feedback. Do you mind if I poke you for a follow-up? Repeat as necessary. Never had to use the M word. Still honest and transparent about your intentions. Still expecting only one commitment at a time. So they're free to say, oh, I'm busy, and you can just follow up with someone else. You're free to reach out to multiple people at the same time, get different feedback and learn from all of them, expanding your network. It's the thing I have found that has produced the most success, but there's no guarantees. As I said, it's a passion industry, the rules of supply and demand. But it's still the advice I give. And I'm sorry, that was like half the podcast, wasn't it?
So you gave a lot of good advice. A lot, you said a lot of good things in there that it's very hard for me to try and target a single piece.
I'm sorry, so, I'm not good at
this. No, that is perfectly fine. What I was getting at with that is I'm not going to attempt to follow up on any of that, just because you said so much stuff in such good detail.
That, oh, thank you.
The only thing that I can really add, as someone that has works as a programmer, that went back to school for design, incorrectly for design, because I wanted to go back for UI UX. However, at the time, it was 2010. That was a part of the industry in general that was still not fully fleshed out with a proper term if you didn't know the proper term. Yep. And other places were teaching UI UX without knowing the proper term. So to follow, well, I am kind of going to poke at a few things you said, but as as someone that went through that, I think you know where I'm going with this, but as someone that went through not following what they actually wanted to do and got into something that they weren't really at, like they enjoyed, but not a huge fan of, because what they wanted to do was something different. I agree completely. And I think that's fantastic advice that people should, flesh out or poke about to try and find what it is they actually enjoy doing and drill down on that and follow that. Because sometimes you hit the high level and you're like, oh, cool, this is it, without realizing that no, you want the low level and you have to do some work to find it. just because sometimes you don't know that low level exists.
Exactly.
And as well, as I said, you know, someone that went to school for design, portfolio reviews and making a portfolio, all of that, a little different in the context of games, especially because this was 10 plus years ago for me now. However, I can say with certainty that having a portfolio, as you said, keeping it up to date, and knowing how to take review and how to incorporate, that is also fantastic advice. So thank you for sharing that, because, you know, it's hard to know how to take advice. And as you said, not be one of the two extremes of just going, oh, cool, thank you, I'll do that, or I don't want to do it that way. Because, you know, it could be very true that that's not how you wanted to do it, that that's not your vision. However, a thing that I personally learned when I was getting review or critique on something that was in the opposite direction was asking for their interpretation of it, or what, you know, how they envision that. Because sometimes they might say something that you can incorporate, that, you know, even if everything else isn't the direction you want, they might say something that you can be like, oh, wow, that's actually something I can apply. And it still works within the realm of what you would like to do. Yep. So like, you know, yes. So sorry. So everything you said, like you said, a lot of stuff there. And I think all of it is very, very good information. And I'm not going to try and pull apart any of the other stuff there, just because outside of those few comments, you did a, you know, there isn't much more for me to try and ask to get some more information out of you or what have you. So thank you for all that. That was wonderful advice.
It's my pleasure. And thank you. Honestly, that's very kind words. I hope it helps someone.
Fingers crossed as well. Cause you know, it's that's one of the reasons I asked this question, because, you know, I hopefully in some way or shape or form, this can give back to some people and help. Right. Like, you know, why do something and put something out there if you don't hope it benefits somehow to someone, right? That's my view, at least. I'm not to enforce my views on you.
Absolutely. No, I agree 110%.
So, Osama, the one thing that I don't think you actually covered when you were talking about when you were younger, making, you know, card games, little videos, board games, and, you know, moving on to that and making flash games and you know, everything else, I don't think you actually touched on if there was a game or a set, like a few games that you played that made you go, oh, this is what I think I need to do. This is what is interesting me and made you want to follow it. And if you did, I apologize. I missed it completely.
Okay. The truth is, if you think back to my story, I didn't even consider it a career goal. So if you're talking about which games made me want to join the industry, the answer is I never had that moment, because I didn't have a game that said I want to do this. I had a person who modeled that, you know, that it's possible for someone like me to do it. However, there were games that inspired me so much to just create outside of the industry, just to make games myself, that I that seeped into the DNA of who I am and have stayed with me since I've played them. I will mention two games, if that's okay, if that's allowed, if I'm not breaking the rule too much.
You are more than allowed to break that rule. It is not a steadfast rule to begin with.
Thank you. One of them is Street Fighter 2. Absolutely love that there are two characters on screen. Each have a small set of abilities, and so much can get out of it. There are narratives behind it. There, I learned so much about visual design, of like why certain characters have certain visual elements to accentuate the movement or things like that. All the different backdrops, all the different play styles. Like, I learned so much from it playing it. It, like, if you've ever played a fighting game, you understand that there's a science behind it. There's like data behind it that you can mine. There's a strong metaphor of being a fighter that is represented in the fighting games themselves, learning combos and executing them and things like that. Absolutely loved that genre for both the competitive side of it. And even though I'm not really a competitive game player anymore, I play versus games. It's just not, I'm not as competitive as I was. And also my reflexes are slower because I'm older, but that's a different story. But just that, I loved playing it with friends, but just the elegance of how few moving parts. And the second example might sound like a very different type of game, and it is, but a lot of the things are in common, and a lot of things are different. It's Final Fantasy VI. It was called Final Fantasy III when I played it in North America, but it is the Final Fantasy that preceded Final Fantasy VII, which was the first 3D Final Fantasy. That Final Fantasy, with just a few pixels, and, you know, like MIDI chiptunes, created such an emotional, vivid journey, and like had put me through so many emotions and so many feelings. I lived an epic. I lived an adventure, and half of it was in my imagination because of the abstraction of the game. They did so much with so little, relatively speaking. It's a masterpiece. Like it's one of my favorite games of all time. Definitely in my top 10 games. And it always inspired me again going forward. I am possibly the scrappiest game designer that I've ever, like, compared to anyone other game designer that I've worked with. Not going to say best or worst, or that's not the qualifier I'm looking for. Just in terms of how I'm constantly trying to do the most possible with the least moving parts, because these two games are in my DNA. If that makes sense. Like, what is the smallest expression of this that could give you the feelings that you want, that could give the player the experience that they're looking for? That is my philosophy. And these two games informed that, even though they're very different from each other, they did that in their own way.
So thank you for sharing that. And, you know, I'm not going to be able to say I understand completely, because, you know, that is a thing that is unique to everyone. I want to frame it that way, that wasn't meant to be like I can't relate to that, but that's hard for anyone to relate to. But I understand the inspiration for something and how that can distill down and that can direct you and like kind of live through you. That's a really weird way to say it, and I hope that makes sense. But I understand that. And, you know, that's really, it's always good to hear that sometimes, like, the games that do that are so not the same. If, yes. You know, I hope that makes sense what I'm trying to say.
It makes perfect sense, because those concepts can be widely applied. They can be abstracted and made into a framework and then applied to so many different. I've worked on over a dozen different game genres since I started, and I always apply these principles whenever I can.
And, you know, that's amusing to think that out there is a completely unrelated to fighting game that has the principles of Street Fighter 2 just breathing through it. You know, that actually started as a little bit of a joke. I'm curious how that, like, how you would approach something like that. Like, what would the distilled elements of Street Fighter 2 be that, if you were making a game that had nothing to do with fighting, make you go, this is the stuff? Like, can you connect those dots for me, please?
Absolutely, absolutely. I'll give you an example. So Street Fighter 2's characters are an expression of playstyle. And I'm talking about mechanically. So an example of this is some of the characters are aggro, fast-paced. They're coming close quarters, and they're trying to hit you a lot of times, and they're trying to interrupt your moves. Other characters are also close quarters, but they're grapplers. They have a hard time getting in, but once they're in, you're in trouble. And other characters are keepaways. They're keepaway characters that, like, stay far away from the screen and spam the screen, you know, like crazy to keep you out of the way. And others are also far away, but they're not spamming. They are turtling. They have defensive tools, and they're waiting for you to make a mistake as you approach. If you map these playstyles, you could look up a thing called orthogonal differentiation, where you could get gameplay, you put them on two axes, close quarter, fast or far away. And then you could say rapid, for example, rapid inputs are like fast-paced moves to slow moves. And if you break it down into that, you have you can understand what you're building. If it is answering to the play styles that you want to support and what you're missing. So that's why a lot of the games that tried to clone Street Fighter 2 failed. They replicated them on a surface level without digging deep and understanding what's actually happening. There were many fighting games that clone Street Fighter where everybody was Ryu and Ken. And there was no differentiation in the playstyle at all. They had maybe slower projectiles or faster, but like they really played exactly the same. They had no grapplers, for example, or they had a grappler and the grappler was broken because the grappler was moving extremely quickly. And like they missed the understanding of abstracting that elegance of how do you play this game? How do you break that down into rules? And how do you only add something that adds value? And if you look at other games in different genres and how they applied that, look at StarCraft. And how they had a class that was based on aggro. And then they had a class that was based on defense, on bunkering. And they had classes that were kind of in between that had different strategies. But within that spectrum, they were able to create different build types with different units that answered to different build types. So they had like this Venn diagram of these units can support this build and this build. But overall, this... an orthogonal... In their case, it's more differentiation on three... quadrants. They are supporting the different play styles of these players and all the races. Like they needed exactly three races for the play styles that made sense in their game, and each race was a different expression of that gameplay. And that could be applied in any genre where you have options that are asymmetrical that try to answer the same question. Like if you look for Marvel Snap and you look at the different deck types, what are the winning conditions and how are the decks trying to achieve it? There are decks that are trying to destroy their own things for value. There are decks that are trying to destroy your things so you have fewer things on your side. There are decks that are combo pieces, right? And if you put them on putting their combo in place, and there are decks that are more aggro, they're trying to go for the quick victory. Even though in Marvel Snap, you have six rounds, the quick victory is I want to do my thing before you do your thing to prevent you from doing your thing. That's the expression of aggro. Aggro in Street Fighter is I'm coming at you really quickly with a barrage of attacks so that you interrupt all your things and you can't move. Aggro in StarCraft is I am building up my resources extremely quickly so that I have a bigger army and I'm sending it to you very fast. And aggro in Marvel Snap is I'm doing my thing first and forcing you into a playstyle. It's almost an aggro control. Forcing you into a playstyle that hopefully is not the playstyle you want to be playing in, so that you're playing suboptimally and I'm going to win that way. All of them is aggro, but they're all aggro like as an expression within the confines and rules of their games. It's abstracted. So if you approach the games that way, you say, not I have an idea for a character, and I like the way this character look, and I have a backstory for this character. Okay, but how will this character play? I don't know. Details. If you don't approach it that way, if you approach it the way of Street Fighter, where it's like, we have, Street Fighter 2, we have eight characters. Orthogonal differentiation is eight very distinct quadrants. You have the extremes, like the extreme close quarter, the extreme keep away, like Dalsim versus Guile, and then you put each one on a point. You have exactly eight characters. That's exactly how they designed their characters. Like, well, how do we give the different playstyles? And the only thing that broke that is Ken and Ryu, that were very, very similar. They had a little bit of differentiation, and they left a quadrant or a point empty. But that was an inherited thing, right? They have eight points, and they had Ken and Ryu, who came from the game before, who were the only playable characters and who were identical to each other. And so... it's a near perfect expression of this, but they kind of had to make that concession because they wanted to carry over both playable characters. And if you look at, I'm sorry, I can keep going. There's no need to keep going, but like that's how you do it. You look at what they did. You analyze why they did it. You extract the rules. You create a framework, and then you apply it whenever it fits. Because some things don't fit. Like this is, like I mentioned before, if you're doing anything where it's competitive and has asymmetry, this is when this applies, right? If it doesn't have asymmetry, then there's no point in doing orthogonal differentiation. What are you differentiating? If you only have one character, then you don't do orthogonal differentiation. But if, let's say, that character has a choice of weapons, then you would do it because you're allowing your players to choose the weapon that they're approaching the combat in. And one could be slow and does more stun, and one could be fast and does bleed or what have, depending on the game that you're playing. You know what I mean? So like, it still applies for asymmetry specifically.
So thank you for explaining that, because that makes I understand completely now how that all works. Like, you connected those dots. So I very much appreciate that. And it's very interesting to hear it, you know, hear it spoken about like that. Because that,
my pleasure.
You know, I'm now understanding a little more when I hear people talk about fighting games. However, I'm also understanding a little more how like game designers' brains work when they're looking at a game and trying to find transferable, I'm going to say skills in air quotes, but transferable skills and such between. So thank you. That's very interesting and very, very informative. Sorry, I say it that way and it sounds kind of dismissive, but no,
it's educational.
Thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure.
So Osama, I do want to ask this, yes. You know, because before we got started, this was one of the questions that you had said that you were interested in talking about. And I would be remiss if I did not intentionally go out of my way to make sure we spoke about this. Now, I don't remember the way that you specifically phrased it. However, this is how I phrase it. Mm-hmm. So was there a game that you enjoy that you don't feel enough people know or that you don't feel just gets enough credit?
Yes, there is actually an incredibly obscure game that I think I've yet to meet a single other person who has played it that I haven't directly recommended that they play the game. I found it on itch.io and it blew me away by its elegance and its beauty and its replayability. It is a turn-based, hard to describe. It's not an RPG exactly. It's just a series of combats, but like with a cast of turn-based characters, where you roll dice. That's really the concept behind it. It's called Slice and Dice, and yet it uses those dice in ways I've never seen before. It has incredible layers of depth and strategy based on different combinations of you know, like passive abilities and build types and things like that. It does, again, so much with so little, and all the moving parts make it incredibly fun to enjoy. And nobody knows about it. It's like this little hidden gem that I feel like if people gave it a chance, not only would they fall in love with it, it's going to spawn a series of Me Toos, games that are similar to it that like kind of pick up on some of the mechanics and in a similar way that Vampire Survivor did it. It actually, to me, it's reminiscent of Vampire Survivor, except that Vampire Survivor became a big deal. But that's the level of quality I see that this game is bringing. And yet nobody's heard of it.
So thank you for that recommendation. You know, as you were describing it, I quickly pulled it up on itch and this looks really interesting. And I understand completely what you mean by it's hard to kind of describe because, you know, there's to be, you know, completely honest, there's a bunch of different dice games out there. A lot of them, and I imagine to some degree is this as well, because it's a dice-based game, but most dice games have a lot inherited from board games, right? RPG ones especially, just because that's the nature of it, right? If it's something that could have been done on a board, it's probably easier to do digitally. And just looking quickly at how this one works, it seems...
Yeah, it's
much
not
harder
that.
To describe. It's so much harder to try and describe. Like, off the cuff, I guess. I would say it almost just from the one little gif or what have you. It almost feels like Yahtzee-ish in the sense of you're trying to roll your dice to fill out a specific roll, but that still doesn't do it justice. So thank
That's
you.
That's very that accurate because like what you do is you have characters and each character has a die, one die with six faces, and that defines who your character is. And when you're rolling your die, you could re-roll it a set series number of times and that number can fluctuate based on passives. And so your combination of your five characters and what they can roll has a huge like, you know, impact on the strategy. You're looking at enemies that also roll dice, that also have d6s, that are, but they don't reroll, of course. That's the only difference, is the they don't reroll. But there's a layer of spells that you could cast because some of your die can give you mana. There are items that you could equip to modify your die roll and the die rolls of the enemies. And the dynamics make for so many fun combos. Like, that is how hard it is to describe how fun and interesting and expressive in gameplay this game is. They, again, do so much with so little. It is elegant and beautiful and much, 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 much deeper than it has any business being. For a game I downloaded and expected to spend 5 minutes on, I probably played this for over 100 hours.
And, you know, I can understand how. So yes, you know, it just seems like a very, very straightforward on the surface, but obviously as you play it, there's probably more to it that, like, it gets more involved. And it's an interesting concept in that it's like taking from just from what I'm reading, from what I'm seeing, right? It looks like it's just taking and going with it. So thank you for that. I'm going to check this out later now, and it's a horrible time to say that, just because, you know, we're recording this on October 20th, and for anyone that knows explicitly what that day means, it's Mario and Spider-Man Day. So it's a very difficult day to say I'm going to check something out, and yet here I am because it looks so interesting. So thank you for that recommendation.
It's my pleasure. I can't wait to hear what you think of it.
Oh, now I have homework, man. Okay.
Yeah, you do.
Okay, I'll make a note. Try demo. Report back. Okay, well, thank you. But no, in all honesty, thank you for that recommendation. It looks, you know, anyone that's listening, check it out. It looks really neat. Now, Osama, I don't want to keep you here for too much more time. You know, before we started talking, you also mentioned it being Mario and or Spider-Man Day. And also it's getting a little later in the evening. So I don't want to steal your Friday evening away. But so
it's been a pleasure talking to you so far, just saying.
Awesome. Well, I'm very happy to hear that. So, but what I'm going to do, I'm going to hit you with two quick questions. One is an actual question. One is, you know, more of a wrap up, and that's that way that'll be, so we can get you out of here. You can go enjoy your evening. And you know, what have you, unwind for the weekend.
Of course.
So it's kind of in the same vein as unwinding. You know, we've spent a lot of time talking about game stuff. And one of the things I do like to ask and, you know, touch on is that game developers and people in the industry are people. They're not living, breathing game machines. Some are perfectly fine. Never going to speak ill in that direction. However, I do like to always ask, outside of games, outside of playing games, making games, what have you, what else do you enjoy doing? And, you know, does any of that help you, or is any of that part of how you relax?
Yes. Okay. I love this question. This is a great question. I have, as I mentioned earlier in the episode, I have ADHD, so I do way too much outside of work. I have a ton of hobbies. As I mentioned, I teach and I love teaching, but I also do pro bono mentorship whenever I have free time. I love public speaking. I know that's an odd thing to say for so many people, because apparently that's the biggest fear of anybody in the world ever, is public speaking. I enjoy going on stage. I just like it. I know it sounds weird. I can't help it. That's just how it is. I love organizing events. Community events. I used to organize a lot of game jams. Now one of the things I do is with a small group of friends, we organize Polaris, which is a game design retreat where we get game designers from all over, I want to say all over the world. It's mostly North America and Europe, if I'm perfectly honest. We go to a retreat and we write white papers on game design. Like, we think about really hard game design problems that are not necessarily something linked to our work, and we write white papers on it. And I find that incredibly fun, which other people will be very confused about, but still. I have a ton of side projects. I'm currently working on a board game for fun. I know you said not game-related, but this is not job-related. This is, like, separate, right? I'm also writing a book. Right now, I'm writing the outline for a book that I'm going to continue writing as soon as I'm done with my board game. And I have tons of other little projects in varying degrees of completion. But none of that is relaxing. I like work. I like doing working things. If I had to pick a thing that I really like that is relaxing, there's a reason why the game design retreat is a retreat. My favorite thing in the world is to sit in a jacuzzi and do nothing. Which is a stark opposite of all the other things that I like doing. And I think that's exactly why it's my favorite. It's when you're in a jacuzzi, there's not much else you could be doing, right? So that is my happy place.
So, you know, thank you for sharing all of that. Polaris sounds very, I've never actually heard of Polaris before, and that sounds really interesting and amusing that it's a retreat dedicated to writing white papers on video games. But more specifically, I'm happy that you also get to find your happy place and just relax in a jacuzzi during this or any other time. I don't know if you like go to the YMCA or some other gym just to sit in the, you know, you're that weird guy that goes to the hotel just to go to the swim, the pool and sit in the jacuzzi. But, you know,
whenever I travel, I always bring swim trunks and I always go to the jacuzzi if there is one in my hotel. So, yeah, you called it.
So I want to be clear, when I said the weird guy, that was more the weird guy that stays in his own town to do it.
Okay, I don't do that.
That's where the weird guy comes in. You know, I grew up in a small town, and I took swimming lessons, obviously, at a hotel. And every time, and now that I'm thinking about this, has layers to it, but every time there was that same guy sitting in the jacuzzi,
living his best life, right? I'm loving it. This is, I'm on team weird guy.
Let's not peel back the layers that this the other aspect of events happening. But yes, innocently, yes, he was living his, I can't.
Oh, no.
The context of the realization now is it was a guy that kept going to the hotel to sit in the jacuzzi during children's swim classes.
Oh, okay, that's a little bit different.
Like I said, it wasn't until I started mentioning this that I really started to unwrap. But okay, anyway, let's move on from this revelation that I have here. Anyway, Osama.
Yes.
Like
yes.
I said,
what a note to end on, Link. We were doing so well for like an hour.
We were doing so good. let's roll around. Like as I said, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. Let us aim to get this out on a good note. As I said, I want to let you go. I want you to enjoy your Friday night. I want you to enjoy Mario or Spider-Man or what have you. But if there was anything else you wanted to discuss, a cool game, what you were doing, something you feel more people should just be aware of, by all means, the floor is yours. As well, please let everyone know where they can find more information about you so that I can include that in the episode description.
Of course. You know what? A lot of what I do public speaking about these days is not game design as much as it used to be. It used to be I used to talk about like how to make games and the rant I went through before about orthogonal differentiation is the type of thing I would do. So the more I stay in the industry, the more I see that what's needed is actually talking more about the issues that are facing game devs. And that is a thing that I feel people need to be aware of, especially if they want to get into the industry, but also if they're in the industry. Things like, you know, all the issues that we're facing. I'm very pro-union, for example, like how markets affect our keeping our jobs or losing our jobs and how different companies can potentially exploit us, but also living with mental health issues within the industry and burnout and crunch and other things like that. So I would encourage people who are interested to learn about this, not to discourage them, but to arm them so that if they do get in or if they are in, they are protected from all these different things within reason. Because, you know, you can't stop everything, but you can do your best. So as in parallel to learning about how to get into the industry, learn about the industry itself and its practices, and take steps to take care of yourself. I hope that wasn't a somber note, because I meant that as a positive one. is that okay to end on that?
Yeah, no, I understand completely what you are saying. And, you know, I think that makes perfect sense. I think people should be aware of. And, you know, not to try and like put a negative twist on it or what have you, to hopefully to add on to it, that it's, you know, it kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier, that it's important to know what you're doing, what you're getting into, because if, like you said, it's the game industry is a passion industry, and it's possible to hang up so much of your happiness of yourself. You know, as anyone that's a creative knows, you're always pouring yourself into what you're working on. And, you know, it's very much a reflection of you, a part of you. And it's very easy to have those things when something rebounds or bounces off what armor you have, it hurts, right? So it's, yes. I think it's very important. I agree completely that it's a positive thing that, or a proper thing that should be discussed about steeling yourself to the reality of it and mitigating or managing, I think is the better word, managing expectations. Because, you know, if you have a better idea of what you're walking into, then as you're going into it, your mental health isn't going to take such a blow. Like if you know that right now the industry is kind of harder to get into because of recent events with layoffs, you're not going to take it as such a blow when you're getting less responses or you're not getting that job, because it's not a reflection on you per se. It's a reflection on the industry at large. And like being aware of those things and talking about them and having positive conversations about them that encourage you to explore how you're feeling, or explore the negatives in a controlled and positive environment. For anyone that doesn't know what that means, it meaning more like discussing it with someone where you're not just going to constantly be doom and glooming about it. I don't think that's a somber way to end. I think that's a very good piece of advice. That is good advice that is just hard for some people to understand as good advice. Because, you know, it does have, like you said, the other side of that coin can go bad really easily, and make it, you know, disappointing or what have you. However, like I've been saying, I understand what you're trying to say, and I agree completely. You know, being able to have positive conversations about the industry surrounding and how it affects and how you can be prepared for how it will affect you are fantastic things. Sorry, I'm rambling there, but yes, I understand what you're saying, and I agree completely. It's fantastic advice.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, and I hope people take it to heart. To answer your other question, if people would like to reach out to me, two methods are preferable. One is you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm literally the only Osama Dorius in the world. I challenge you to find another. I have yet to find one in the 44 years I've been looking. I think that is a unique name, and therefore it makes it easy for you to find me on LinkedIn. I'm also Osama Dorius, one word. Or basically on, I don't know how to describe it. It used to be Twitter. Now it's X Twitter, I guess, which is accurate. Yeah.
The hellscape formerly known as Twitter. I think
there you go. I love that.
We should all do it now.
Yeah. The symbol is an X. I don't know how it's pronounced.
We don't have time to unpack that one.
No. Those are the two methods that you could reach out if you'd like to.
Awesome. So thank you so much. Those, as I said, I'll include in the episode description. That way people can find you, get in touch if they would like, or you know, learn more about you or whatnot, right?
Absolutely. Welcome.
Now, Osama, as I said, I'm going to let you go. I'm going to get you out of here. You can go have dinner, play Spider-Man, Mario, what have you. So unless there was anything else, I'm going to get out of your hair. I'm going to stop bugging you.
Link, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I'm already looking forward to the next time I come on.
Thank you so much. I'm happy that you enjoyed yourself. I will make a note and I will bug you in the future once I figure out how another episode like this can work. But I very much appreciate your time. And yeah, so I, like I said, I'm going to let you go. So thanks again, Osama, for making time to have this conversation with me. And thank you for joining us on the Red Tunic podcast, as well as a special thanks to Ronald Jenkins for the use of music from the title track from Roads Deep. And be sure to check out the episode description for links to socials, websites, and other means that allow you to learn more about or support Osama and the podcast. And while you're doing that, share, like, follow, and whatever else makes the algorithm work. Thanks, until next time.